Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Nathan Ross. Great to see you, Nathan. Really looking forward to today. We had such a superb conversation last time. Must be, I don't know, about a month or so ago now. I just felt it was like people talk about like-minded people, right? One of my mentors talks about like-hearted people. You know, and I just thought I just felt a real alignment, like-minded and like-hearted. And I guess the main thing that I loved was the positivity. There's this world of adoption. There's so much talk about trauma. And one of the only questions that's always on my mind is where's the line between understanding the trauma and moving through it. And that is, for me, that's about the light and the positivity. So great to have you on the show. I'm really looking
yeah, thanks forward. For having me.
Yeah. So could you introduce yourself to the listeners, please, Nathan, and then we'll get into the show.
Of course. Well, I'm Nathan Ross. I live in the United States, specifically in like the Kansas City, Missouri area. I was adopted from the foster care system in the States when I was a teenager, and transracially adopted. So my adopted parents are white. We have a huge adopted family. There are 28 of us total in my family, and 23 of us are adopted. So I began sharing my own personal story when I went off to college and have done that work for the last 15 years, and then began working in the child welfare system specifically about 10 years ago. And I just graduated from grad school and got my provisional license to do therapy. So that's a new part of what I'm doing in my everyday work, that and consulting with child welfare organizations and state systems to improve child welfare policy and practices around the United States and parts of Canada.
Wow. What a way to sum everything up in a nutshell. It's fantastic. The bit that intrigues me is the mix there of what you're doing now in terms of the therapy side and the consultancy side, and the systematic change that seems to me kind of a little bit unusual. I don't know, but fascinating. It must be a fascinating mix.
Yeah, it's new, but it's been really exciting so far. I have a lot of personal, of course, experience, and then professional experience, and being able to use those things to improve the systems for a lot of people all over the world is just, it's fulfilling. So that's really nice.
Yeah, totally. It's inspiring me. It's inspiring me. I mean, obviously I'm in the UK, so we're at the tail end of the day. You're doing this on a Monday morning. I'm doing this on Monday evening. You're lifting me up. And I've got another podcast recording after this. So I've got a slightly later day than normal. So that's great. I love to ask this question to all my guests in terms of what comes to their mind when they hear this phrase, thriving adoptee.
Thriving adoptee. I guess what comes to mind for me is when I hear a thriving adoptee, it's a person who's able to navigate their world in what they consider a successful way. So I know that's not like the super easy answer, but, and I say this all the time, people are so complex that I don't think that there is a one script that can fit every person, you know, and every personality. So it's the ability to navigate your spaces in a way that you feel competent and confident, and you feel like you have a happy and fulfilling life.
Yeah, I'm just scribbling some notes now. So what's the essential things that you've learned, Nathan, that helps adoptees do that, do all those things that you've talked about?
Yeah, it's the ability to have lots and lots of chances to make up for parts that might have been missed prior to adoption. And so again, it's, some people focus on, because I worked a lot with young adults in the last part of my career before I became a consultant. And people always try to figure out, like, what do young adults need to be successful? And how do we, get them to a place where they're thriving? And so some people will focus on getting them housing ready. And some of them are focused on education. And some of them are focused on finance. And really, it's all of those things at different points in time for different people. And so that ability for adoptees, especially to have practice, to have someone that's going to say, you know what, if you're struggling with relationships, maybe you did not have healthy role model relationships prior to, then it's the ability to start doing that around people who are safe and will be able to do that and be able to provide some stability. If it's that you're struggling with maintaining your education or being able to get to a place where you can thrive in school, it's that ability to, again, have multiple chances to do that over and over again. And I think one of the issues that I see in our system here in the States is that we kind of expect perfection quickly. And so, you provide a chance or two, and if you don't get mastery of that within the allotted time frame, people kind of give up on it. And I think that's where we really start to see a lot of struggles for adoptees is, someone says, oh, you're not good at relationships. And so they give you a diagnosis and they move you on throughout your life and just say, well, this person is, we'll say, rad. So they don't know how to do relationships. They don't know how to do healthy attachments. And that's the end of the story. Instead of, okay, this is an area you struggle with. So over and over again, I'm going to show you this is how you engage in relationships. This is the give and take. This is conflict resolution. This is what that looks like until you gain confidence, until you get that mastery. I think that's absolutely what's necessary for anyone, but especially for adoptees to get to that place of thriving.
So you're saying really that the system is a little bit impatient then?
Absolutely. We expect a lot from kids and from young adults. It's odd because we expect more from them, I think, in some circumstances than we do from adults themselves. And I think that's especially true in child welfare. There's just this expectation that they're, little adults walking around, and we miss that there's a lot of development that has to happen. And that only happens around safe and stable people who are able to provide those opportunities.
Yeah. So, does the therapy play a role in there, in that safety?
For some people, and I'm a new therapist, and I had therapy as a child, and so of course I definitely see value in therapy. But therapy in and of itself is, to me, most helpful for people who want and can use that type of service intervention. So while I could say yes, everyone should have therapy and everyone should be in therapy, people have their own lives, and I think you get to make your own choices. And so if that's not an avenue that's going to be fulfilling for you, then that's okay. I do think it's important for people to find out, like, is the life I'm living serving me in the way I want it to right now? And if it's not, finding what can help you do that. So if it's friends, if it's family that can help you get to the life that you want to live, great. And for some people, it's clinical. Sometimes it's addressing mental health, but sometimes it's addressing your environment, though, as well. And moving to a new place or getting a new environment will do much of the work that therapy could do.
Yeah. To me, I love this tailorization you're talking about. Like everybody's different solutions, different people. And I'm kind of weighing that up with what you're saying about the system. And I'm thinking the system can't cope with all this personalization, can it?
No, it cannot. I mean, that's the problem with institutions, and everyone and people in general. We want things to be categorized. We want a simple formula that everything falls into, that if I do this, this, and this, I will always get this outcome. And we as people are just too complex to have the exact same formula for every person. And so a true system, like a really good functional one, would be able to adapt and tailor to every individual based on what they need.
Yeah. So for me, there's quite a big learning point here, though, in the fact that I speak to a lot of adoptive parents expressing concern about education, for example. And the education system is not set up for adoptees. I mean, they are in the minority, adoptees and foster kids obviously in the minority, and the system is set up for the majority. So yes. Partly, like, if we kind of accept that the system isn't set up in our set up for us, then it takes, for me, it takes some of the sting out of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we are, you know, if we're more realistic and we have a better understanding of the system not being set up for us, it doesn't mean that we don't, you know, we're not going to advocate it, but maybe we can advocate from a place that's perhaps less frustrated with the system. And if we're less frustrated, then hopefully we're going to have better communications with the people that matter in our kids' lives.
Absolutely. And so, like, with the education example, so we have a system that's structured, you know, like, you go through all the grades, you learn this at this point in time. And I think that's perfectly fine. What I would do in an ideal world is, at any point that an adoptee or someone from foster care is coming into a new education setting and they've missed out on important pieces prior to coming into that setting, then our outside community comes in and provides that missed piece. So we're not telling the school to revamp for every single kid, because that's unrealistic. Like, that's not going to happen. You have things that you have to achieve, but our community could come in and pick up those pieces that are missing, which is pretty much what happened for me when I came into foster care. I was educationally way behind. They considered even holding me back because I had done so poorly in school prior to coming in care. But I was very fortunate that I had mentors and tutors. So I had people who would come in and get me up to speed. And by the time I graduated high school, I was on track with the rest of my peer group. I was able to go off to college and thrive. And so it's that piece that we have missing is, okay, so you missed out on the education. And we just say, oh, well, hopefully you figure it out through just being in the world. And that doesn't happen. So we add that piece in. That's what I would like to see.
I think that's great. Spot on. It's not, yeah, it's for something to me, it's all about that expectation. So at the moment, this is a parallel side, but, you know, like, I realized a couple of weeks ago that we're having some building work done, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized I've been getting frustrated with a number of different things with this builder. And I realized I'm the one doing this to myself.
Oh, yeah.
I'm the one whose expectations are too high.
Yeah.
If I lower my expectations, then I'm not going to be as frustrated when I'm dealing with the builder, and I'm more likely to get a resolution. So I guess I'm trying to draw out a teachable, kind of like a teachable moment here for the listeners, in terms of if we're getting frustrated about this stuff. Well, usually it's down, you know, in this case, it was down to me, and my life has been a little bit easier since I checked in on these expectations.
Yeah, it's that realistic expectation. I think that's what gets missed, is that we think, oh, you should be here. You should be here. And so I'm pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. But really, realistically, you might be here first. Doesn't mean you can't get there. But if I'm realistic about it and you're here, then I have more grace for you and can put a lot more effort into getting you to the place where I think you could be.
Yeah. Yeah. Very succinctly put, far better than I did. I was doing it. It's cool. There's something we talked a little bit about resilience last time we spoke, and there's something to me that's kind of behind all this thriving stuff. So you talked about, you talked about relationships, you talked about education, you've talked about development, you've talked about practicing and healthy role models. Is there something to me, there's something behind all this in terms of what's the common factor? What are the foundations for all this? For all these things that are happening in the world, you know, is it resilience? Is it emotional intelligence? Is it self-esteem? You know, what would you say is the kind of like the underpinning, the foundations for us to thrive?
I would actually say it's connection. And so like my company that I'm starting is called Resilience Recognized, and the name ended up changing, and I'm glad that it did. And the purpose behind that, the name that I have now, is understanding that everyone who's coming to you at any point in time, the fact that they're coming to you, to me, is an acknowledgement of inherent resilience that they've had up to that point. So the way that they're living their life, however they're living it, is done in such a way that they are adapting to the circumstances that led to that point. And so I think that that's important to acknowledge. And, you know, sometimes, and I hear this with, I've heard this even for myself from people, is that, oh, you have resilience where other people don't. You have an innate resilience, and we have to build that. We have to get that in our other kids. And I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think we have to recognize that where they are is because of the life that they've lived, and that's okay. And again, it's their life. So, you know, the resilience piece, I think, is hard to just say like it's some golden magic thing. I think that that is a piece that we all have. Where I think we start to see it shine, though, is with our connections. So when I got healthy connections to family, to community, to social supports, that's where I started to really build on the inherent strength that I already had, because I was connected to the right people. However, if I had gone to a different community, or had lived in a different family environment, or had stayed in the family environment that I was in prior to coming into foster care, I would not have graduated high school, absolutely. I would not have healthy relationships now, absolutely, because I would never have learned those. And so people would have, looking at me today, if I had stayed in that environment, thought, he doesn't have any resilience, that's why he's like that. And I don't think that that's true. I think it's the connections. We need people. We can't do it alone, no matter how much we think we can, no matter how much we want to. We need people, and we need the right people at the right time to get us to the place where, again, that resilience is recognized in us.
Yeah. Because I remember having a conversation with a psychologist who was, you know, specialist in this, the adoption area, and we were talking about adoption trauma, and I said, well, what's the difference that makes the difference? And she said, well, it's resilience. And I said, okay, great, so what makes the difference there? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, it's this and this and this, and they were all external factors. They were all external factors. And I said, well, that's great. But those are all external factors. What about, surely this is an internal, this is an internal issue too. And she said, well, yeah. I said, well, what's the difference that makes the difference there then? And she couldn't answer it.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really interesting, a really interesting thing, given that she was in the field that she was in. And for me, I think perhaps as we speak and I listen to you, I think my take has been perhaps a little bit too inward looking. And her view was a little bit too, well, was wholly external in terms of what she could articulate to me anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas what you're saying is more perhaps, it looks at both the internal resilience within the human being and also how that ties in with the external stuff in terms of, you know, external people. We all need people. No, I don't normally quote poetry. I'm not a big poetry fan, but there's a line in a John Donne poem, "No man is an island."
Oh, mm-hmm.
Or yeah. I guess these days we would say no person is an island. This was before we were all politically
yeah.
So no man or woman or no person is an island.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit into the internal part and how you see it?
Yeah. To me, internal, the piece that is at this point in my life most important is that willingness piece. And so there is, you know, you can, again, we give lots of names to lots of things. And so some of us will say temperament and personality and motivation or your perseverance and all of those things, you know, that we can use the internal driving force. And I think that that's all great. That willingness to accept what's coming to you from the external is, I think, what drives the two coming together. And so if I don't have, you know, there's lots of stuff that's being done around genetics, and you inherit, we of course inherit physical things, but we're learning more about inheriting psychological traits and things like that. And so if I am predisposed to having a short temper, quick to anger, which I am, both my parents, not great in that field. So that's something I'm going to struggle with. Then I have to acknowledge that and be willing to accept supports that help me bolster that piece so that I don't fly off the handle every time something displeases me, you know? And so I could say, well, I have an anger issue, and just leave it at that. And then everything that comes to me externally, I say, well, I can't address that. I have an anger issue. It can't be helped. But that's not going to satisfy anybody. No one's going to want to be around me, right? And so realizing that, I had to realize that really early. Okay, so now I have to be willing to do something about this anger so that I can function and have that fulfilling and thriving life. And so I think that's a big piece, you know, that some will say like personal responsibility. There's all kinds of words, but I think like at the core, can I receive the things around me that are going to be helpful to me getting where I want? I think like that's the biggest internal piece that we could help, or at least, you know, navigate with young people as they try to identify that and navigate that with adoptees, is what is that openness to receive those things?
Yeah. I think that's great. Just as a bit of an aside, as you were talking about anger, first off is, well, this is an aside, but you know, we've spoken a couple of times now, and you seem really chilled to me. You don't seem like the short fuse guy, you know. The other thing is that we watch a lot of telly. I think Americans are watching more British telly than they used to do, I think, because maybe our telly's getting better. I think we're watching more of yours as well. But one of the shows I watch, we do watch some not highbrow stuff, shall I say, including Blue Bloods. Have you seen this show, Blue Bloods?
Mm-hmm.
No, okay. Mm-hmm. It's an American cop family.
Yeah.
Led by the guy that was in Magnum back in the 80s.
Tom Selleck,
yeah. Led by Tom Selleck. He's the police chief. And they're Irish, you know, the Irish American. So there's the angry one, you know, the second son or the eldest son, I can't remember which one. He's the one that always flies off the and this is all to do with angry Irish people, apparently. But he doesn't strike me. He doesn't strike me as the sort of guy that you would describe as willing, you know, or right. having a willingness. As you're describing that, the other ways that I thought about, you know, when you're talking about willingness, the word that came into my head was coachable. Well, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. kind of like, so willingness is almost like willingness to listen.
Yes,
and coachable is probably maybe the next step on from that, which is, you know, I'm willing to be listened. You know, I'm willing to listen. I'm coachable. I am. Sorry, I'm not describing me. I'm just describing anybody here. that you know, somebody who is open to changing their
right
philosophy on you know they've got that sufficient self-awareness to want to be open to change, to be coachable. And I guess so coachable seemed to be kind of downstream of willingness, and then upstream of willingness, the word, the thought that came to me was like curiosity. Mm-hmm. So like, am I curious? Am I open to, am I open to looking at something new, or may I consider looking at something new? Willingness is a little bit further on when the fans of the curiosity have been, the fire of curiosity, the spark of curiosity has been flamed, the fans have been flamed, and then coachability, that next bit. Is there anything else that comes to your mind with that when we talk about that willingness? And maybe, you know, from your work with young adoptees, anything that you could share with maybe adoptive parents listening to the show that could help them in this regard from what you've learned?
Yeah, I liked the three points you made, and that's very similar to like how some therapy models address addiction. You know, so you start with the curiosity piece. Are you even, what would it be like? Am I willing to think about like, is there something different? Is that possible? And then once I'm curious about that, then I can start listening to, these are potentially the issues. This is potentially what it could be like. And then that coachability is the taking action, is how I hear that. You know, now I've listened to it. Now I'm going to start putting that into practice. And I think that's super in line with a lot of what we see in good practice and just in good like human being relationships. And then the piece I would add for parents of adoptees is that meeting, it really does matter if you meet the kids where they are. Like it's absolutely crucial. And again, it's understanding the realistic expectations. And so when I was met where I was educationally, relationship-wise, even employability, you know, when I first got a job, all of those things allowed me to be curious and then want to listen and then want to take action because people were investing in me and they were seeing me for who I was at that time and willing to still move forward with me. And I think that there was not that pressure of, I'm supposed to be this. I'm supposed to be able to do relationships exactly this way. I'm supposed to meet this exact standard. There was a realistic expectation of this is what you can do based on the experiences you have. This is your worldview right now. Okay, I think that there are some places where you could enhance or improve, but for now, this part is okay. We will meet you there. And I think that's super important. Again, that goes back to an external piece more than an internal, but it's also necessary for adoptive parents to understand. You know, and we see this with, we see with adoptive parents who adopt babies, but we especially see it with when you adopt older kids is parents have missed out on all of those formative years, all the bonding that happens when you bring a baby home from the hospital that was in the womb of the biological mother. You know, you miss out on those subtle pieces of connection that we tend to have in traditional families, but we assume we'll have the same relationship with the 10 or 12 year old that we would have had if they were born into our family. And I think that that's a big, you know, misconception. And so you have to acknowledge that there were pieces of that relationship forming that were missed, and you have to meet them where they are, acknowledging that while you weren't there for that gap, someone was or something was, and things happened. And so you have to be able to go back through and address that and work with them through that, teach them new or different skills or enhance the ones that they've already developed and move forward. But it's complicated and it's hard and it's super frustrating. It deals with a lot of rejection, potentially. I would probably say often different types of rejection, and that is hard to take on. And I think there's also an expectation of adoptive parents that they have to be saints and perfect, and you need to be okay with being rejected, and you need to be okay with having someone not trust in you or confide in you or attached to you. And I think that that's unfair. And so there's like a whole lot that needs to be done in terms of that, as you mentioned, like self-awareness. And I think just general awareness that once you have, you can start making those appropriate expectations for yourself and for your children.
Yeah. So we're back to expectations and patience, really, aren't mm-hmm. we?
Yeah.
I want to take you back to the resilience piece and the resilience recognized bit, because mm-hmm. I think where I felt really aligned, where I felt our philosophies met when we spoke last time, was this the innateness of this of resilience. And I was talking to an adoptee about this over the last week, and was it he or she? I can't remember. I think it was a he. And he said he felt that he was more resilient because he was adopted. And do you feel that way?
I have a hard time with resilience. Like I have a hard time with it as like a magical concept. I do think that I'm resilient. You know, it's the ability to overcome adversity. I think that when you have adversity and you survive it, I think that you inherently, like, it's just part of us surviving as humans. You become, or you tap into the resilience that's there. Now, there are absolutely people who certain adversity would crush them and they wouldn't be able to move forward. Absolutely. But that's different for every person. Like what I overcame, what I lived through was not fine, but it matched what I could do. I've worked with other people who've had different stories that I don't know that I would have been able to handle the same way. And they are functional and they're thriving. And I'm like, I don't know that I could have done that. And so I have a hard time saying it's reserved for this type of people who have had this type of experience. But with that said, there is a lot of adversity that comes from being adopted, especially if you're adopted older and you have a knowledge of trauma and your birth family. If your community recognizes that you're adopted, of course, this is especially true for transracially adopted people. So there are a lot of things that you will get used to being in adverse situations and having to live through them. And I think that that absolutely strengthens the resilience that people have. Yeah. Versus, you know, when you live in a homogenous place where everything looks the same, you're given all the opportunities necessary. There's not a whole lot of chance for adversity. So your resilience probably isn't as strong, but it doesn't mean it's not there. I think it's actually probably a fortunate thing that you don't have a lot of experience where you've had to strengthen that. That's probably, you know, what we'd all like is a fulfilling life where we don't have to be resilient every day.
Yeah. It's fascinating, and it's a rabbit hole that we can disappear down. My take on it is really, really simple, but completely counter to most stuff I've come across. And you know, it has been informed by people that I've learned, you know, mentors that I've learned from. I think for me, you know, the name of your new company is Resilience Recognized. And I think resilience is recognized rather than strengthened. And why I think that that's the case is because I think we're all born resilient. Mm-hmm. And that resilience is tested to different degrees. So I don't think my resilience has been particularly tested, not from an adoption perspective. I don't think it has, but I think we've all got it, but we don't recognize it. So I think resilience is recognized as, you know, as it is in the name of your business, mm-hmm. rather than strengthened. But I think that the world thinks it's strengthened, like going to the gym, mm-hmm. and the reason that it's important that people understand whether it is innate and it is revealed through hardship, or it's strengthened by going on a resilience training course, is if we buy into this idea that it's something that's outside us, a skill that we have to develop, then that sends us down, it sends us on a wild goose chase, because we're going to be looking for something outsiders that is actually already there, and it's going to be very frustrating because we're not going to, you know, we're not going to find it by looking outsiders. We are going to see it when we look within. Does that?
Yeah, and I think it's more. I think strengthen to me makes more sense than creation, which is the part that I have a hard time with. Is people want to create resilience in individuals versus recognizing that it's there. But the strengthened piece for me, for example, like a car accident, you know, My grandma even was in a car accident not that long ago, and it took her ability away. Like, she didn't want to drive anymore. Now, it doesn't mean she doesn't have any resilience or ability to overcome adversity, but that was a new experience for her, and it shocked her so much that she wanted to give it up completely. But through repeated exposure to driving with my sisters, who went out and took her and showed her it's okay, and she was able to strengthen, enhance what she already had, the ability to overcome adversity. If we take away the word resilience, the ability to overcome adversity is inherent in everyone. So what she had to do was recognize that she had that ability to overcome adversity. This particular issue was driving. So she had the ability to overcome the potential adversity of driving over and over again, to the point where she's able to drive now on her own. You know, and so I think it's language. I think we're probably getting to the same piece. I don't think that you can add something into a person that's not already there. I don't think we create resilience in people. I think people have that resilience. What they might not have is the exposure to it, to overcoming adversity, and then they need that. We do that again with relationships as well, with kids who have suffered trauma, from anyone that's suffered trauma. It's that being exposed to, because you gain this worldview that life will never be the same, or I can't be happy, or people are distrustful, and I need to be worried, I need to have my guard up. And so that's one of the ways that your inner resilience has kind of overcome that adversity, is to protect yourself, you know, from letting potential danger in. And so what we do is we help you recognize that, yeah, you have that, and that there's a reason why you have that. But is that exactly what you want? And if it's not, then we're going to give you that exposure, the ability to practice the type of relationships that you wish you could have. And then we're going to strengthen or enhance or give you the ability to overcome that type of adversity, to the point that you are where you want to be. You know, and so like that's the type of practice I do for therapy. That's the work I did when I worked with young people specifically, is meeting them where they were and giving them the opportunities to do that slow, gradual practice exposure to things that are scary for them or hard or seem impossible, so that they recognize that, yeah, you could do it. You could do it all along. You just needed a safe place in which to do it.
Fantastic. I love it. Again, I think what you're doing is so what you're talking about here is resilient, this stuff, this overcoming adversity, whatever it's called. It's something that is experienced. So at the moment, we're talking about it in a in or, and largely I'm talking about it from a theoretical kind of theoretical way. And you're bringing in some you're giving in practical examples, but more importantly, that you're talking about how it's the practical stuff, it's the practical sitting in the car with your grandma. It's that through that, then it's an experience. The ability to overcome the adversity is experienced. It's seen not as just a kind of like a nice idea, I wish I could do that, but it's an experience. Resilience is it's something that's experienced. It's not something that is learnt in a classroom. And the little analogy that I've got for that pops into my head is, like, I'm a keen swimmer, right? So there's this guy that comes down to the swimming pool, and so triathlons are quite trendy here in the UK, and I know, that you've got all the Ironman stuff, and most of this stuff comes from the States. Anyway, we follow you guys and that stuff. There's a swim instructor who teaches. So most triathletes come from either running or cycling. They're not swimming is usually their weakest, is often their weakest sport out of the three. So they pay him like £150, $150, £120 an hour for him to improve their swimming skills, right? And I've seen this guy talk at the triathlete for like 35 minutes. And I'm thinking, swimming is about swimming. It's not about teaching. You know, it's like, well, and there's videoing them, and I'm thinking, well, show them the video, show them the video, and tell him where he's going wrong with his strokes and what he could do better. Give them one thing to focus on. Get him to try it. Video him again. Show him how he's changed. Show him what he's still doing. It's a practical thing.
Yeah.
It's not a theoretical learning exercise. You know, riding a bike. There's a book, isn't there? You don't learn to ride a bike at a conference or something like that. Is that correct? this is practical stuff. So Absolutely. We have to. You've said it a few times, practice healthy role models. You've talked about practicing, you know, driving again for your grandma. You've talked about practicing relationships. You've talked about all that stuff. This is so the adversity is overcome through experience.
Yeah, because that's how it was for me when I learned to swim. I was terrified. And so my big sister, we aren't related or even adopted, but she would, I wore life vest. I had all the floating devices on me. I was so terrified of drowning. And so the way she helped me overcome that adversity was I would jump into the water into her arms. And so I would know that she was going to catch me. And then as I got more comfortable and trusted that she was going to catch me, she would eventually let me fall into the water and then pick me up out of the water. So I would get used to, okay, you didn't catch me, but you were there to make sure I didn't drown. And so she did that over and over again throughout the summer. And eventually I started getting rid of the floaty devices until I didn't have any of them on and just knew that she was going to help me get out of the water. And then we started going into the swimming lessons. So it took all summer and she was super patient, but the way that she did it was incrementally, making sure that she was there, making sure that I had lots of opportunity to practice and realize that I was safe, that I wasn't going to die from this experience, that I already had the ability to overcome it. I can swim perfectly well today. So she just had to help me get there though, instead of telling me, oh, jump in the water, you'll figure it out, just float around or watch this video. You know, like it doesn't work that way. I couldn't sit on a couch with a therapist for the summer and learn how to swim. You know, that's not gonna work. There are things that could work for. Swimming is not one of them. There's a lot of practical pieces to life, to living life, that take the ability of actually doing it, getting a little scared, getting a little bit out of your comfort zone, and then increasing that until you have the mastery you need.
Yeah. So my dad taught me to swim, and I don't think I was scared of the water, but the way he did it was there was less and less air in my water wings.
Yeah.
Till the way, you know, they had the water wings on, but there was no air in them. But obviously I had the, you know, I was three. So my dad used to talk about this a lot, the fact that I swam the breadth, you know, the width of the pool, which would be, I don't know, 10 yards, say. I swam without my water wings, whatever they call them, things, and the day before I was four. So the reason I'm telling you is that obviously the more trauma that there is, the more patient we've got to be.
Absolutely.
So I just had less and less air in my water wings. You had more and more steps in your process, and we're back to patience again. And it may be adopted parents who are listening. I think will Simon stop banging on about patience? But
no, you can't, because it's so necessary and it's realistic. You know, like we had two different experiences that both worked for us, and that's why it's so hard to make a formula, because if I had used your way, I don't know that I would swim today. You know, I think I would be so anxious that I don't know that, but it worked for you. And that's so important to know, what does your child need and how do you then give them the steps that they need?
Yeah. And I've just come up with an answer to my own thing, right? So if people are still listening now and they're saying to themselves, will Simon stop banging on about patience? Then I would say they're actually being impatient when they're saying that.
I would agree. And they're practicing their patience by listening to this still.
We're trying to, there's a hell of a metaphor there. There's a fantastic metaphor in terms of the worse the trauma, the more patience we're going to be, and the steps that we've got to break stuff down. Because similarly, you know, I was adopted at 5 weeks old, so I had the relinquishment stuff that people talk about, and a strange one, really, just to drop in here. My birth mother took me to a foster, I believe. She took me to a short-term foster carer, and so she relinquished me once, and then 3 weeks later she had to go back to that same foster family, pick me up and relinquish me again. Now I'm not talking about this from my perspective,
right.
I'm talking about it from hers.
Yeah,
you know, that must have been to have to go through the same thing twice,
right?
Must have been, that must have been terrible for her.
Mm-hmm.
But I only found out like 6 years ago with them when I got my adoption file. So is there anything, we've talked about inherent or strength and resilience, we've talked about the connections, we've talked about the family, we talked about community, we talked about relationships, willingness, temperament. Is there anything else that you'd like to share in terms of what you've learned that helps adoptees thrive?
Oh, I could probably talk about it for the length of my life, you know, because there's just so many pieces that go into it, and it gets more minute and convoluted the more individualized you get. But I think overall those pieces are probably at the core of how I practice and the work that I do, and really even how I see the broader world outside of adoption and foster care.
Yeah. I think for me, when you said that, that I could talk about it forever as well. But we only got 10 minutes. So I was thinking that there's a danger if, you know, there's danger in that convolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also thinking about how, you know, how people offering to help us have to make it more complex and have to give us these steps and have to, you know, and it doesn't work. Because it's got to be tailored, you know. So the thing that's coming into my head is, like, you know, I did this a course about how to set up a podcast last year, and the guy made it really, really complicated, and actually that put me off.
Yeah,
I thought, well, I can't do all that, and oh well, I have to invest in this, and I have to do that, and you know, will anybody listen to it? And he had to make it complicated because he had to have a long curriculum to sell me in on the idea. Well, there are 7 steps to setting up your podcast on it, and you'll need to do this, this, and this. And so they have to make it more complicated than it needs to be to be able to sell you a curriculum to solve it. There's danger in that. There's danger in these prescriptive models that don't work because every kid's different, every adoptee is different. There's danger there. There's also disappearing down the detail path. We get lost in the detail and then we end up doing nothing, or we end up not trusting our gut.
Yeah, the best way to do it is to walk alongside the person. Like if you're a helper, an adoptive parent, whatever that role looks like, if you're not walking alongside the person and working with them, to me, and this is a generalization, but to me, you're doing it wrong. Like there's no way you can't fix someone else's life. I don't believe that. I think that you can provide guidance and support. You can offer suggestions. You know, that's like what your parents do, but everyone also knows if they lived with their parents through their teenage years, that there's a lot of you rolling your eyes and like, yeah, you don't understand me. Like there, you can't fix someone else's life or live it for them. So there's no way you can create a formula to me or a curriculum that's going to help them without involving them in that process and tailoring it to their responses and what they want out of it.
Beautifully cool. And I would go a step. I mean, you've used the fixed word, so fix somebody's life. I for me, there is a belief in some places that adoptees are broken, and therefore they need to be fixed.
Absolutely.
What would you say to that, Nathan?
I think again, I think it's wrong. And I'll use relationships because relationships to me are a core of what people are trying to fix in child welfare, that ability to navigate and be involved in relationships. I think that relationships are different when you have different experiences. So, by and large, if you've suffered trauma, which even being in foster care in and of itself is to me a trauma, you handle or might look at relationships differently. And to me, different isn't broken and different doesn't need to be fixed. And I think that that's a big piece that I would like to see changed just as an overall philosophy within our field is that because I don't love the way you think I should, you consider it damaged. Now, there's a lot more that goes into that. There are, of course, unhealthy relationships. I'm not saying that by any means, but there are also relationships that I think are okay, and it's okay to be the way you are. You just have to have the right connections, the right people that are going to be able to navigate that with you and are okay with you being that way. And so I think I just don't see fixing. It doesn't make any sense. I don't even know how you would do that. And I think that it also is one-sided. And so we assume that because the relationship isn't working, that it's on the traumatized child, and we never look at the other party, which I think is odd. Like, we just assume that you are the perfect part of the relationship and that the other person's damaged. I think that that's weird. So.
I'm with you on this. I think that seeing anybody else as broken is going to, there's this thing in I've seen this, heard this in school. So if they did some test with, they told some teachers that there were some brainy kids and there were some thick kids. You know, I'm sorry, this is PC. This is not PC, right? And the that affected the way that the teachers interacted, and they mark the high they mark the brainy kids better when there was actually no difference. So, you know, the way that we perceive somebody else affects how we deal with them, and there for me, therefore, there is a huge danger in believing this narrative about kids being broken.
Absolutely.
And if we buy into that, then we're not gonna be the best parent that we can be. And I believe that I believe that the human spirit is actually unbreakable. So that's why we're doing people a disservice. It's like I use the metaphor of the rubber ball. Like we're born to bounce back. we are that rubber ball. But that rubber ball arrived in the post from Amazon in a cardboard box that got kicked around, mm-hmm. and somebody at the distribution center thought, this isn't gonna work. So they put a load of sellotape, a load of scotch tape over the thing, and tried to, and that's how we see the kids as the adoptees, as these damaged goods. But that's how they may look on the outside. But on the inside, they were born to bounce back. They are because of the essence of being that rubber ball. So let's look at what's inside them rather than the outside.
Yeah. Coming from a perspective of positive regard for people versus having people seen as having a deficit is, to me, always better. You know, assuming that you are doing the best you can, and that's okay. Again, there are exceptions. There are things that are dangerous. I'm not saying that you should just go and live a dangerous life. That's not what I'm saying. But that positive regard towards you are human, living through the experiences you've had, and that's okay. Let's move forward as you want to. I think that that's a better way than saying, hey, did you realize that you were broken and you probably shouldn't live that way? I can give you the solution and make you all better through my lens. Like, that's a, you know, dramatization of it, but that's kind of the two lanes I see people go through, and people tend to respond better to the ones who are going to be unconditionally positive, have unconditional positive regard for them.
I love that. And I think that the model really is one of the challenges with this is this societal model that, so mental health models come from physical health models. Physical health models are about broken legs. Mental health models are about broken people. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with them? How can we fix them? What drugs do we need to use to fix them? And they don't come from a positive regard. They come from a deficit, broken model. So they call it mental health, but actually it's actually mental disease. Mm-hmm. They've never called it, well, they used to call it mental disease. Now they're calling it mental health, but they've changed the name. Like, they've changed the name, but they haven't changed most of, from what I can tell about this field, and whether, I don't know what you would call it. It is, a lot of it is still coming from deficit or broken.
Yeah, a disease model.
A disease model.
I think that's accurate.
And this is very important. It's very important for everybody to know that, because if you're dealing with these people, most of them are coming from that place. So you're going to get an opinion on yourself or on your kid that comes from that perspective.
Yes.
So expect them, you know, no scientist. I mean, when I was talking to a friend about this at the swimming pool. We were talking about COVID and stuff, and, you know, no scientist ever gets sacked for being too pessimistic. they don't. I keep on hearing stories from adopted parents saying, look, I just refuse to accept what specialists told me. They have, they're in some place where they have to warn about the worst in case they get sued.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And we need to know where they're coming from so that we can view their work. We can have an informed view on the words that they're coming out as.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish instead of like with mental health, we diagnose, and it's the way to bill. That's how you get insurance. I wish that instead of diagnosing or giving someone a deficit, we could talk more about how certain things might be expressed. So someone who has experienced traumatic events around relationships might express that in different ways, you know? And so I'm not going to label you with anything. You're a person. And if you're struggling, you might express that struggle through running away from people, through verbal aggression, through physical aggression. You know, there are lots of different expressions for it. And there's even like the overcompensation. You might really attach to relationships super quickly because you're, you know, you want that. And so if we talk from you're a person with potentially different expressions, and we never gave it a label of any type of RAD or PTSD even, or you have borderline personality, all of those things that just box people in. And then we start stacking labels on people. So now you have 5 different mental health diagnoses and you're 10 years old. And you've been in therapy for several years and nothing seems to be working because everything's trying to tackle all of those diagnoses and also none of them, you know? And so, but really what it comes down to is you might express one thing in one way, but we can't figure out what that is, or we won't say that and we have to bill for it. So now you have a diagnosis or 2 or 5. So it's one of the reasons I wanted to go into mental health is to really try to change that narrative. And fortunately, that is a place where there are lots of clinicians, which is my overall term for people in mental health, who are starting to take that mindset of getting away from diagnosing and more that humanistic approach of we are all people, and we are dealing with different things at different times in different ways. And that's the part that we can help you navigate instead of labeling you with something.
Fantastic. Fascinating. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for making time for us today. It's been great.
Oh, thank you for having me. Love the conversations.
I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. You take care.
Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.